Right, as I mentioned, tonight's study is on miracles. So this past weekend, I don't know if you knew, we had a youth evangelism conference. This was the second time that we put on this type of conference, and it really just grew out of a desire from the youth themselves to have, you know, a conference like this where it's focused on evangelism and apologetics. And so this past Saturday, we had the conference. We opened it up to not only the youth from CSA, but we opened it up to the surrounding, you know, the area Calvary Chapels. And we actually had a couple of other Calvary Chapels join us in person and online. It was a great experience. I think all in all, it was awesome. The teachings were amazing. You wouldn't believe it, but you'll get a taste of it right now. I'm kidding. Everybody's straight-faced. But our aim with that conference is ultimately to equip our youth to ground them in some fundamental arguments for Christianity, to show the truth of Christianity, right? And as I mentioned to them, it's not just true in the sense of your truth versus my truth, but true truth, right? 100% truth that Christianity is the one true religion and God is the one true and living God. And he has left us evidence here on this earth. And part of that was on miracles. And it was just a great study, and I'm excited to teach it once more. Now, this study really, you know, stemmed from two ideas. One was just my inherent skepticism about a lot of things. You know, so years ago, just, you know, pondering on the subject of miracles and, you know, whether possible and whatnot, this is something that I've always wondered about. And just the way my brain works, I've just always had this sort of skepticism, you know, whenever somebody brings up a miracle claim. Oh, did you hear such and such? It was a miracle. And I'm always left thinking, well, I mean, let's slow down. You know, let's think about it a little bit more, right? And that's just the way my brain works. So part of that, that's where this kind of study stemmed from. And then another one is just skeptics in general, right? Skeptics who, you know, people who obviously don't believe in Christianity, don't believe in God, perhaps. And, you know, they just don't care. And when they read the New Testament and the Old Testament and they see the miracle claims in there, they immediately just go, you know what? You had me all the way up to Jesus rose from the dead. I can't buy that. So they discount the miracles. Not only do they just discount miracles, but they want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. They throw everything out, right? They say, because of miracles in the Bible itself is false. Christianity is false. Everything about it. So I'm going to live my own life, right? So these two places were where this study came from. And hopefully, by the end of tonight's study, I'll be able to overcome that. And maybe this is a stumbling block for you, or maybe you know somebody who's a stumbling block for, and hopefully this will help overcome that. So yeah, skeptics, you know, they'll point to the flood in Genesis chapter 7. How could that even happen, a global flood? I don't even know, that doesn't even make sense. So Old Testament, keeping in the Old Testament, the escape of the Israelites from Egypt, you know, with Moses' miracles in Exodus. And then you have in Joshua chapter 10, the sun standing still for a day to help them win in battle. And then, of course, jumping to the New Testament, you know, one of the greatest miracles of all, you have the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ in the gospel accounts. All these great miracles, and there's hundreds more throughout the entire Bible, right? So there's no question that the Bible is filled with miraculous accounts. But we're left still questioning, okay, are the skeptics right here? Do the skeptics have it right? You know, are these accounts simply fairy tales and myths? Can they be explained by natural means? Or do we live in a world where miracles are not only possible, but are happening even today? Can we trust the miraculous accounts throughout the scriptures? And are they a part of history? Are they really a part of history? And do they reveal to us the truths about God and the universe? Well, that's what we're set out to answer tonight. And I want to set the stage for you guys by sharing a story. I want to start out with a pretty cool story. And this story is documented from a missionary doctor, Helen Rosevere, and she's from Northern Ireland. I can't do the accent, so please bear with me. I mean, I could, but I just don't want to do it. She recounts in a story of hers as she was a missionary doctor there in a village, African village near the equator. And she recounts how she was helping a young mother give birth to a premature baby boy. And she wound up dying after giving birth. It was, you know, they did all they could. but she wound up dying. And so this is a premature little baby boy, and the mother also left a two-year-old daughter. You know, they're crying to see her mom no longer breathing. And of course, being in the middle of Africa, and there's no medical equipment, there's barely any real way of caring for these types of scenarios. But they knew that they needed to take care of that little baby boy because the temperatures were going to drop in the evening. So even though they were near the equator where you think the temperature is just going to stay stable, at least in this village, during the night, the temperatures would drop dramatically. And so they needed to keep that little baby boy warm throughout the night. And so this missionary doctor, her name's Helen Rosevear, she also was there working with the orphans. And as she, you know, later in the day, she meets with the orphans and, you know, she recounts the story to them, say, hey, can we just pray for this family? And this little baby boy, of course, that he gets the medical attention he needs. And so she said, let's pray. We got to pray. And just then, a little faith-filled orphan girl named Ruth speaks up and says, she prays, please, God, send us a water bottle. It won't be good tomorrow, God, because the baby will be dead. So please, God, send us one this afternoon. And while you're at it, God, would you please send a dolly for the little girl so that she'll know that you really love her? And so the doctor, when she hears this prayer, mind you, she's a Christian, right? And she says she was put on the spot. Could she really say amen to that prayer? I mean, she knows that God's all powerful and God can do whatever he wants, but I mean, come on, there's limits, right? Can God really pull this off? So she was conflicted there internally. She knew that the only hope of that prayer being answered is if they were to receive a parcel from her homeland, you know, her missionary sponsors. But the thing is that she's been there for 4 years to this point, and she had never received a parcel. So things were looking pretty doom and gloom at this point, right? Well, let's not discount this yet. A couple of hours later, a Jeep pulled up to the village and dropped off a 22-pound parcel. So they opened the package immediately, expectantly, and they're digging in. You know, they found some food, supplies, some medical supplies for the village lepers that were there. And there at the bottom, as Dr. Helen Rosevear is reaching and she feels something, she says, no, this can't be. And she pulls it out, and it's a hot water bottle that she needs for the little baby boy to keep warm. Wow. What's more is that Ruth saw this. She's in the front row with the orphans opening up the package, and she sees it, and she said, well, I mean, if God sent the water bottle, he must have sent the dolly too. And she goes and digs through it, and sure enough, she finds a little baby girl doll. And she tells the doctor, mommy, can we please go see the little baby girl so we can give this to her so that she'll know that God really loves her? Wow. So, mind you, Saturday when I first taught this, I broke down. I'm on the verge of breaking down. But anyways, the thing is, guys, the information that you're missing here is that this package, this 22-pound parcel, was packaged 5 months prior. It had been traveling for 5 months before it reached that little village. So the question now is this mere coincidence, or could this be a miracle, a miraculous account of God working? So this is a big stumbling block for a lot of people. You know, many skeptics, again, like I mentioned, they will immediately point to the miraculous claims in the Bible and they will reject it outright. Of course, clearly in this day and age, right, of scientific advancement and technological achievements, there's no room for miracles, right? That's what we've been told. That's what we're hearing right now. The more and more we find out about the world, the less and less place there is for God. At least that's the way I've heard it put. And I'm sure you guys have heard it put that way too. But is that true? So way back in the day, you know, it would be easy for us to say, oh, well, that God did it immediately and just say, oh, that's an act of God. But today, there's more and more skepticism. So what do we make of that? What do we make of this story that we just heard? What would you say if somebody asked you, are miracles still possible? How would you answer that? Well, I'm going to give you some spoilers right up front. So I'm going to give you the TLDR version here. Today, we're going to see that miracles are possible. Not only that, but we're going to see that God is still in the miracle business. And plus, I'm really excited about this. By the end of this study, you all are going to witness a miracle. How does that sound? Sound cool? You guys ready to witness a miracle? We got to wait. 10 o'clock news. All right. First of all, we got to start by defining terms. This is where I always start. We got to figure out exactly what do we mean by miracle, right? Because a lot of times we use terms and we're just talking past one another, right? Have you guys ever gotten in an argument, you know, where you're talking with somebody else and you're using the same words, but just for some reason you find yourself arguing, you find yourself fighting with that person, right? Have you ever been in a conversation like that? All the married couples should be raising their hand right now, I'm pretty sure. I know I have. So we have to define our terms. And the funny thing is that today, at least, a lot of us, we're just kind of quick to use the term miracle, right? Students, right? Or whoever's in school, you get a good grade on something. Oh, it's a miracle because I didn't even study that, you know? I don't know what happened there. Or maybe you found some clothes on sale. It was 75% off and you ring it up and it's almost free. Oh, miracle. Or for you parents out there and you're witnessing your kids get out of bed before 10 a.m., miracle, right? Are these really miracles? I mean, I don't know. We got to see what we're defining terms here. Now, in terms of defining it, some people will define miracles as simply the supernatural occurring. Okay, makes sense. What about suspension or violations of natural law? Pretty sure some of us have heard that definition for miracles as well. I once had a friend, this is back in the day when I used to be active on Facebook and, you know, getting in debates and all that. And I had a friend who is a believer, and for some reason, I don't know, we were talking about miracles, and for some reason, she was going to give me pushback. And so I just finally asked her, please define for me, what do you mean by miracle? And she defined it simply as anything good that happens in the world. Okay. So we have all these different definitions for miracles, but they all kind of seem to fall short in one way or another. And so this is a definition that I picked up on, and I really think that it's all-encompassing. I think it's a really good working definition of miracles, and it's defined as a less common kind of God's activity in which he arouses people's awe and wonder and bears witness to himself. I'll repeat that one more time. A less common kind of God's activity in which he arouses people's awe and wonder and bears witness to himself. Notice, this kind of incorporates a couple of the ideas that we talked about just a couple minutes ago, but notice how it defines a miracle as something that's rare. It's a rare occurrence. And this makes sense, right? Because if miracles were just happening all the time, I mean, that'd just be the normal thing. So it has to be a rare occurrence. And there's a purpose behind miracles. Miracles don't just happen in a vacuum. They just don't happen willy-nilly or they're not pointless. But there's a purpose behind miracles. It's to arouse people's awe and wonder. But more importantly, it points back to God. It points back to the source, to the creator. So when we're evaluating miracle claims, this is something that we have to keep in mind. Is this something that is rare? Is this something that has a purpose behind it? Is it pointing to the creator God himself? Okay. And I am reminded here of an Old Testament verse in Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 21. This is kind of cool how it relates. It says, God is your praise, and he is your God who has done for you these great and awesome things which your eyes have seen. So there was an understanding that it was God who is the source of miracles. God is the source of the supernatural accounts here. But notice how it begins. He is your praise. He is the reason. So he's not only the source, but he's also the end goal when it comes to a miracle account. It is to point back to him to bring him glory. Keep that in mind. Okay, if we're satisfied with this definition, then we can move on to now kind of tackle the most popular objection. And I consider this the most popular objection because this is something that I've heard countless number of times. When we used to go out to UT Austin, seems like 50 years ago now, but when we used to go out to UT Austin and evangelize there to the students, and miracles would come up, and sure enough, they would bring up this objection. And I tell you, every time I watch a YouTube video or listen to a podcast regarding miracles, of skeptics talking about miracles, sure enough, this objection comes up. And ultimately, it's not even a new objection. It's been around for ages, you know, hundreds of years now, and just reminds us that there's nothing new under the sun. So these objections that you might approach or come across from a skeptic regarding Christianity, it doesn't even have to be miracles. any objection that really comes up these days has probably been debated for hundreds, if not over 1,000 years already. So don't feel like you got to get caught off guard, or don't feel afraid to answer these objections. There are good reasons. These things have been debunked for hundreds of years now. But let's get back to our most popular objection against miracles. Comes from none other than the Scottish philosopher and skeptic named David Hume. Anybody familiar with that name, David Hume, in here? Some of you aren't, right? David Hume. Now you'll probably start hearing that name everywhere. But David Hume is a Scottish philosopher and skeptic, and he lived in the 1700s, and he wrote a well-known treatise, and it's well-known, and he wrote this section in his treatise, and it's called On Miracles. And here he's essentially trying to prove that you cannot rationally believe in miracle accounts. So if somebody claims to say, says, hey, I just found out a miracle. I found out that there something miraculous happened. You got to come see this. You got to come interview the person. And he's trying to make the case that even if something did happen, you cannot even rationally believe that it happened, right? So what exactly, how did he argue it? I mean, this has got to be some really tough stuff, because this is the most popular objection, right? So let's see. Well, this was Hume's argument. Number one, he defines a miracle as, this is going to sound familiar, as a violation of the laws of nature. So he says, number one, a miracle is defined as the violation as the laws of nature, right? But laws of nature, think the most popular one is gravity, right? If you drop something, it's going to fall to the ground. And then number two, the second part of his argument here is he says that, well, a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature, but also in our everyday experience, no one has experienced anything that has violated the laws of nature. So nobody has even experienced these miraculous accounts, right? So because a miracle is a violation of laws of nature, he's basically saying you can't violate the laws of nature. I mean, they're the laws of nature. You can't violate that. So nobody has ever experienced that. So he's essentially defining miracles away. He says, well, miracles are this, they never happen, so therefore, it's moot. You can discount it right away. Sounds kind of airtight to some people, but is it really that airtight? Well, I don't think so. You see, number one, he assumes wrongly what a miracle actually is. He says it's a violation of the laws of nature. And why do I say that? Why do I say he assumes wrongly? Well, put it this way. Gravity. Let's take gravity for example, right? Gravity states, you know, that there's two objects and at some point they're going to attract one another, right? But the biggest example that we have is if I were holding an apple in my hand and I were to release it, what's going to happen? It's going to be attracted to the ground, right? It's going to fall to the ground. But what would happen if that same apple, I let it go and then I catch it in midair with my other hand? Did I violate the law of gravity? I don't think so. The law of gravity is merely a description of what normally occurs in the everyday goings-on of things, right? But it doesn't account for somebody or something intervening. The law of gravity is not broken. It's just merely that I intervened and I stopped the apple from going to the ground. But he would call that a violation of the laws of nature. So he wrongly defines what a miracle actually is. So, I mean, if God exists, then surely he can intervene in his own creation, correct? If God created the entire universe and everything in it, then, I mean, it's child's play for him to just reach in and intervene. He doesn't have to violate anything. I mean, even consider the account that we just talked about, the story of Dr. Helen Rosevere. Were the laws of nature somehow violated from just normal packing up a package 5 months prior and it happens to arrive at that very moment? Doesn't seem like a violation of nature there. So he wrongly assumes what a miracle is. Now to his second point, he says that no one has ever experienced such a miraculous claim. So nobody has ever experienced the violation of the laws of nature. Again, here, he's not accounting for intervention. If you can intervene, it's not a violation. And what do you do with all the miraculous claims? Right, we're going to get into a little bit about how many miraculous claims there are throughout the world, throughout history. Can all of them really be wrong? Can all of them really be incorrect and untruth, not truthful? What do you do with those claims? So he was wrong on both counts. And today, even today, philosophers recognize how bad, truly bad of an argument this is. Now, I want to let you in on a little secret that in philosophy circles, if your argument is really, just really, 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 really bad, they call it an abject failure. And guess what? There's a book called Hume's Abject Failure. And here's a quote from it. It says that the parts of On Miracles, which was the section in his treatise, that set Hume apart do not stand up to scrutiny. Worse still, the essay reveals the weakness and the poverty of Hume's own account of induction and probabilistic reasoning. And to cap it all off, the essay represents the kind of overreaching that gives philosophy a bad name. Ouch. Another quote, another philosopher wrote, "The view that there is in Hume's essay, any argument or reply or objection that is even superficially good, much less powerful or devastating, is simply a philosophical myth." Okay, there. So we have it there. That's a smackdown, guys. That's what you call a smackdown. Hume's argument is bunk. Nobody really thinks that Hume's argument is any good, except for skeptics who want to hold on to this type of bad reasoning in order to have some sort of vindication that they can discount the miracles in the Bible. But if they're pointing to Hume, if that's all they got, then that's not much at all. So what do we do? What do we do at this point? Well, now that we've established that Hume is wrong here, tremendously wrong, what do we do with all the miraculous claims? Let me tell you that a recent poll showed that 38% of Americans believe that a miracle has happened in their life. Okay, this is just in the USA, right? 38% of Americans. That amounts to approximately 92 million people. 92 million. That's a good amount. Now, for the sake of argument, okay, let's say the skeptic says, well, not, I mean, you know, people make miraculous claims, but really, how many of them are truthful? So let's, for the sake of argument, let's say out of all those 92 million people, let's go ahead and give them the benefit of the doubt and say 99% of these miraculous claims from 92 million people are wrong. That still leaves you with 1 million miraculous claims. 99, so only 1%. Are we willing to say that over 1 million people who come forth and say, a miracle happened in my life, can we just kind of brush them away so easily and say, no, it wasn't a miracle, it was something else. We can explain it naturally. 1 million people, are you ready to just count them to the side? Well, I believe that miracles are still occurring and they're occurring more often than we think. I want to share with you another miracle story. It's unique and powerful in that it is one of the most well-documented cases. And this story revolves around a woman named Barbara Snyder. You see, in the 1970s, as a teenager, Barbara was a budding gymnast and she played flute in the orchestra. But then symptoms began appearing. She would trip, bump into walls. She was unable to grasp the rings in gym class. Eventually, her condition worsened and she was admitted into the Mayo Clinic where her diagnosis of progressive multiple sclerosis was confirmed. Over the next 16 years, her condition deteriorated to the point where one of her lungs was rendered non-functional, while the other lung operated at less than 50%. She needed permanent medical intervention just to be able to breathe. They had to insert a tube into her throat. She also lost control of her urination and bowels, and she needed a catheter and a bag attached to carry her bodily waste. Not done yet. She was also declared legally blind. She was unable to read and only capable of seeing objects as gray shadows. On top of all of this, her muscles and joints were becoming contracted and deformed because she could not move or exercise them. The prognosis was dire. In fact, one of her physicians, Harold P. Adolf, declared, "Barbara was one of the most hopelessly ill patients I ever saw." By 1981, she hadn't been able to walk for 7 years already. She was confined to her bed and her body was twisted like a pretzel into the fetal position. There was nothing else the physicians could do. It was just a matter of time before she would die. So she was admitted into hospice care just for palliative care. Until one day, someone called in Barbara's story to the radio station, requesting that their listeners pray for her. And we know at least 450 people wrote, prayed for her because they wrote letters to the church, letting them know that they were lifting her up in prayer. And then on Pentecost Sunday in 1981, Barbara's aunt was visiting her to read some of these letters that came in. And suddenly Barbara heard a man's voice speak loudly from behind her, though there was no one else in the room. And this voice boomed and said, "My child, get up and walk." And Barbara motioned for her friend to plug the hole in her neck so she could speak. She was getting agitated, so they knew that's how she needed to say something. And she wound up telling her aunt, "I don't know what you're going to think about this, but God just told me to get up and walk." So she felt compelled to follow these supposed divinely given instructions, and she jumped out of bed and removed her oxygen. She found herself standing on the legs that had not supported her for years. Her vision was back, and she was no longer short of breath, even without the oxygen. Her contractions were gone, and she could move her hands and her feet freely. When her mother entered the room, she dropped to her knees, feeling Barbara's calves, and she screamed, "You have muscles again!" Her father came in, hugged her, and whisked her off in a waltz around the family room. The next day, Barbara came in for an examination to the doctor's office, and an x-ray of her lungs revealed that they were perfectly normal again. Even the collapsed lung. The intestine that had been vented to the abdominal wall was reconnected normally. And she eventually was restored to complete health. She could see perfectly. Her doctor declared, "This is medically impossible, but you are now free to go out and live your life." And she has now lived for over 35 years with no recurrence of her illness. How do you explain that? It's an amazing, amazing story, and it's well documented. Two of the physicians that were working on her case, they wound up writing books about it. Well documented. An immediate healing. And how do you explain that naturally? How do you explain, also couple that with the fact that shortly before people were praying for her? Not only that, how do you explain the voice that she heard right before telling her, "Get up and walk," and at that moment she's healed? How do you explain all of that? Well, this is a very well-documented case, as I mentioned, and there are many more. In fact, this story that just recounted can be found in a popular book called, from Lee Strobel, you know, Case for Creator, Case for Christ, that guy. He also wrote a recent book called Case for Miracles. And this is where this story is found. And it has a few more compelling cases within. Not only that, but there's a humongous two-volume, over 1,000-page tome from Craig Keener called Simply Miracles, where he details a lot of documented, as well as he can, a lot of documented miracles that have occurred. So going back to Hume's point when he says, nobody has ever experienced such a thing, how could he know? I mean, he didn't travel all across the world. He wasn't all-knowing. He couldn't have known. But yet we have many, many reported miracle claims. We can't just discount them all. Plus, when you have so well-documented, that's exactly what the skeptic is asking for, right? Show me the evidence. If you could show me the doctors, the x-rays, you know, all these things, then I might believe. Here we go. Here's just one story. How do you explain that? But, you know, inevitably, we have to confront the issue of when miracles don't happen. That's right. When you pray and God seems to be silent. In Psalm 13, David starts off by saying, "How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me?" Like I said, there's nothing new under the sun. This problem has existed for such a long time when God seems to be silent. So these are no doubt tough moments that may shake your faith, and truthfully, there is no easy answer. Ultimately, I don't think we'll ever know the exact reason God chooses to perform miracles for some but not for others. But what I do know is that he is real, number one, and that he is sovereign. And that there is coming a day where all will be made right. And that's predicated upon the historical fact of the resurrection, which is well attested. So we can have faith, we can trust, because God has acted over and over, and we see the miraculous things happening all around us if we are truly looking. So we can hold out for hope, knowing that God, there's a bigger picture at play. that only God is privy to, and he's carrying it out to fruition. And there is a promise to his children that we will one day be free from the burdens of this life. So, you know, we're not promised a cush life. I think hopefully most of us in here know that. We're not promised a cush life. In fact, as children of God, we're promised persecution. That's one thing we're promised, persecution in this life. But we're also promised strength and grace in the midst of our trials. Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9 and 10, where, you know, when he was praying for that thorn in his flesh to be removed three times, and yet this is what God answered him. My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. And Paul goes on to say, therefore, most gladly would I rather boast in my infirmities than the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. What a perspective to have. Something we all need to be reminded about. So if this is something you struggle with, if this is really a stumbling block for you, when God seems to be silent in your life, I encourage you, take heart in the miracles that God is still performing. Some of the ones that we just recounted today. He is real. And be encouraged even by the people within the scriptures that when even though they prayed for healing, they were not, like Paul. And of course, our Lord and Savior Jesus, who endured until death the pain of the cross. Now, with all that, we've defined what a miracle is. We've gone through the most popular objection. We've debunked that. And we've even shared a couple of miraculous accounts. But as I promised you in the beginning, right, we're going to witness a miracle. No, I'm not. I don't have any props up here. It's not going to be anything on me. But I wanted to share this one more miraculous claim with you, and it's a pretty special one. And this is about a case of a Texas pastor. His name's Dwayne Miller, and he lives in the Dallas area. In 1990, he contracted the flu, and it wound up destroying his vocal cords, to the point where for the next 3 years, he was meeting with specialist after specialist. He met over 60 specialists, and they all just kept telling him, I don't think you're ever going to be healed from this. I don't think you're ever going to speak normally again. So his vocal cords were messed up. There was scar tissue on the vocal cords. And so he just constantly talked with a raspy voice, like, like that. That was just his normal voice now. He had to get used to that for 3 years. And then finally one day, his old church asked him to teach one more time for them. He said, we just want to hear you again, hear you teach. And he said, okay, I'll agree, I'll teach. And he decided to teach on Psalm 103 about the healing power of God. And it was during this teaching that God stepped in and did something amazing. And I mentioned it's a pretty special one because that teaching that he gave was actually recorded. And in the middle of that teaching, as he's reading Psalm 103, his voice comes back. And they recorded that teaching. And that teaching, I want to at least give you a couple of minutes snippet of when it actually occurs. So you're going to be witness to a miracle. And if we can we play the audio?
Fire settles in. understand this right now.
Isn't that amazing? Did you guys hear that? So we witnessed a miracle, guys, where for 3 years, the doctors told him, you'll never speak normally again. Now, to top it off, he went back to the doctors, obviously to get examined, like, what's happening here? And they showed him that the scar tissue was completely gone. His vocal cords were back perfectly normal, as if they were, the scar tissue had never been there. How in the world do you explain that, right? And what's just amazing is that we were able to get that recorded, and now he's sharing that with the entire world. A miracle happening in real time. I think that's amazing. This is the God we worship, guys. I'm just in awe. You know, the God who created the universe and everything in it is still working within his creation to this day. The God we serve has not abandoned us. And day after day, he is silencing the scoffers and the skeptics. And what's more, all of his children in here, we're all witnesses to his miraculous work in our own lives, from turning a heart of stone into a heart of flesh. That's an amazing work. We're new creations. We should be shouting his works from the mountaintops, right? So to close this out, I want to leave you with the words of the psalmist in Psalm 96. I want this to be our motivation. I want this to be our battle cry, if you will. Psalm 96, verses 1 through 4. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to the Lord, bless his name. Proclaim the good news of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations, his wonders among all peoples. For the Lord is great and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much.